Okay, we will wrap up this session with a talk by Jonas Lundberg, who is the director of Urban Future Organization in Gothenburg, which has won numerous awards and has exhibited and published worldwide. Lundberg is a visiting lecturer at Chalmers University and also unit master for Diploma 16 at the Architectural Association School of Architecture in London, and is also the head of digital design at the Faculty of Architecture and Spatial Design at London Metropolitan University in London, where he is running the Master of Architecture and Digital Design Systems course. Lundberg won the Reba Tutor of the Year Prize in 2003. His current and ongoing research project, Environmental Catalysts, in collaboration with Stephen Hardy, is attempting to develop new holistic architectural design strategies and propositions for how we can live, mitigate, and adapt to climatic change, dwindling resources, pollution, and the consequential natural disasters through innovative use of digital design and fabrication technology in the design of increasingly resilient urban built environments. Please join me in welcoming Jonas Lundberg.
And mankind, long ago, declared war on each other. It's time to broker some type of peace, but one thing is for certain, nature is not necessarily good. This is my energy, in a way. People keep telling me, if I keep drinking this, I'll probably die. I'm probably better off from orange juice or something like that. But I'm not so certain. This is my house. It's called Nested House. And it's probably the most anthropocentric story of Nested House that you can hear. This is my failed attempt in killing a piece of nature. This is my daughter, Alva. She suffers from allergies, from dust, from vermin, from lots of different things. My wife does as well. So we had to do a few things to our old house here in the UK. Lots of the old Georgian terraces, dusty, lots of exposed brick walls. Not necessarily a good environment, and there's also lots of particles in the air outside. So we had to build a new house inside the old terrace. We made something quite simple. It's just really a CNC shell inside, covered with lots of polyurethane. Layers of polyurethane to create this vapor-proof house. Okay, it's all white, it's all clean, it's easy to, I guess, wash it down, make sure that you don't get too many too much organic material inside the house. And all of it is pretty much to a passive house standard. We've installed shutters, new windows, insulated it, and so on. And it's airtight, and there's only really one way in and one way out, unless you open a window or a door. You can get in through the vents, you can get out through the fan. And this was all good until we celebrated Christmas last year. We brought in a Christmas tree, and this is when the problem started. Okay, after a while we had a tree, we had a gingerbread house, We had a bowl of fruit. It was warm inside. And something happened. We started to get lots of insect activity around the house. Started with that. And then in a couple of days, we also had mice in the house. And we could not work this out, what was happening. My daughter and wife, they fell quite ill. So we had to actually leave the house. So in the morning afterwards, we went to Anti-CMEX, which is a kind of a pest control. That was the wrong one. There. And they figured out that the mice had entered through our skylights of the house. Basically, because we have lots of urban fox on the street levels here, the vermin reside to a large degree up on the house here. And when we constructed here, there was still a layer of organic material on the roof of the house, under the roof deck. And a large mice colony had nested inside the roof. And we opened those windows, are actually the only kind of natural vents. So the mice entered through there, went all the way down the back wall and into the kitchen. So not a pretty story. We went on holiday. They couldn't even do something because we had to leave the house that day. We had to tear down the gingerbread house, throw everything out. And this is a week before Christmas, and the gingerbread house was already collapsing. So we went on holiday. I did a bit of research on gingerbread houses, which is quite interesting how many things people do. But I was interested in the structural failure of gingerbread houses, and I didn't know that there's a big industry of people actually making them. And they put disclaimers inside the kits or the houses that they deliver that they may not last until Christmas because it's so much more humid and mild, so the houses collapse much earlier. So many of the bakers, they consider changing the recipes of the gingerbread to have more bicarbonates and other things inside, but as in most cases of this sort, they're not so certain that that's the only truth, because people are also putting much more icing, using a lot more sugar on the gingerbread houses, and this basically makes the gingerbread absorb a lot more water, so it gets soft earlier. So they don't really know if it has to do with climate change or if it's something else. But it's a big crisis in the gingerbread industry. We came back to our house, and we had been closed for about four weeks. And it was a terrible stench. The mouse family was dead. We had lots of insects inside the shutters inside. They were also dead. And when pest control came back, they basically said that nothing was alive in the house any longer, so we were okay. And this made my daughter feel really bad about this. So since then, we've actually nurtured our mouse garden on the roof. So we kept putting sawdust, keep having the mice up there, and I hope our neighbors don't know that we do this. And I'm quite hesitant about opening both skylights and the terrace doors because you never know what's going to happen. But it's quite amusing, actually, to see this. There's quite a few mice around. Anyway, to come back to what we're talking about here today. The built environment has been in context for thriving ecosystems or for ecosystems that were dependent or developed by man from the beginning of human settlements. So it's very difficult to separate, in my mind anyway, what is man-made, what was infected by us, and how these things changed. I mean, you even find examples here. This is Salar de Uyuni in Bolivia, when they have this famous garbage desert, you know, it's like out of something in a surreal painting, where the pollution, or the way that garbage has been disposed, have had it created another type of system. I found this type of scenarios quite interesting, and some species obviously thrive in urban environments: pigeons, rats, cockroaches, and there's lots of different plant species. And then some other animals struggle, right? Like the bats. We've seen lots of bat houses today. And what we do know is our cities are getting denser. We're going to get crazily dense cities in the future. I mean, here we can see the difference between the U.S. and Sao Paulo, for instance, but it gets worse. I mean, this is a part of Beijing. 32,000 people per square kilometer. It's an incredible concentration of people in one place. We find this quite interesting, how we actually deal with the situations. So there's no doubt that we are facing overpopulation and climate change on one hand, and demographic shifts on the other. With newfound natural resources on the other hand, these conditions have already projected cataclysmic consequences or adaptive opportunities in nature, sociopolitics, and economy. The ecosystemic specific interventions like biome-specific, biodiversified urban and economic developments, and the man-made countermeasures, such as carbon economies, emission caps, and passive building standards, are invitingly or transforming our architectural discipline. I mean, I don't think there's any question about it. And lots of people have talked about holistic understandings in a way of architecture today. I think we very much subscribe to this idea. We are primarily interested in exploiting the host of complex relationships that build an overall building ecology. And basically, this diagram is probably quite familiar. It's a slight modification that we've done to the diagram. And this obviously adds lots of complexity to what we're doing. Sustainability. This is a page out of Arup's marketing material. We've done some work with the urban team in Arup's. And on one of the competitions we worked, this was the CV they sent us. Economic vitality, energy, climate change, mobility, access, environmental health, water quality, cultural issues, health and well-being, mix of uses, education, governance, tourism, materials and waste, security and safety. The list goes on. Does this mean anything? Well, I think the problem with sustainability is this, that it's become something that everyone, again, is saying that they're doing, but no one is actually saying exactly how they're doing it. I mean, this is pretty much similar to maybe a university mission statement. It says everything, but really nothing. Okay, so I'm going to talk about this thing. I've titled the talk Urban Stoichiometry. Some of you might be familiar about this from chemistry. You can also talk about it in ecology. And the stoichiometry considers how the balance of energy in elements affect organisms and the interactions in ecosystems. Ecological stoichiometry has a long history in ecology, with early references to the constraints of mass balance made by Liebig. Locke and Redfield, this research area in ecology has recently gained momentum by explicitly linking the elements of physiology of organisms to their food web interactions and ecosystems functions. I think what we find quite interesting, I mean, regardless if this is right or not, I think architecture, for us, it's interesting in the way that you can make the best architectural project from the stupidest idea, but you can also make the worst architecture from the best idea. I think this is what makes our discipline interesting. So I'm actually not so interested here in the facts, if this is right or not, but rather about what we can do with it. This is where actually we spend, where I spend most of my time. It's on my practice, Urban Future Organization, when we try to use some of the ideas that we develop in teaching and in research in practice. I'm not going to talk about this today, but I'm going to concentrate on other things that kind of inform our practice and the way we think about it. So this is a bit strange. You know, Michael was so clear with his diagrams yesterday. I was sitting this morning and thought maybe I should make a diagram. And it got really, really confused with lots of branches, people, ecology, nature. And then I figured that it's not people, it should really be about living organisms. And then at that stage, I kind of gave up and realized that maybe I'm not ready to draw a diagram, which is basically going back all the way to Leonardo da Vinci. If you have a project, you can draw a diagram. And I think this is something which is still ongoing. So I'm actually not saying that the thing that I'm going to show you now, it's stuff that we are still developing. We don't fully know where this is going to take us. So the IPAT equation is an equation that deals with our environmental impact. And that's supposed to be somewhat related to our technology, population and affluence, Okay, so there's one missing here. And we've started up doing that in three different research projects, extreme environments, basically dealing with large auxiliary structures, adaptive ecologies that dealt a lot with manufacturing and the way we think about more sustainable production processes. And what we're doing right now, which I find quite interesting in relationship to this talk, it's called the cybernetic insurgents. That deals in a way with how we deal with living systems in cities. So our students in the past, they worked on lots of infrastructures, mineral accretion in the Dead Sea, fish farming, volcanic mitigation, algae farming, you name it, agriculture in Namibia, coastal protection in the Maldives, methane gas harvesters in Siberia, casting of ice in Greenland, mushroom farming and the Chernobyl site in Russia. And it's all kind of projects that the students have set up to work on as a thesis. And together, some of these ideas have amounted to an idea. This is a book for some years ago from the AA Agenda series. It deals in a way with projecting ideas about climate change, and how we can actually be part of actively forming the way the climate is changing. So it's a collection of projects. It was edited by my colleague, Stephen Harding, that I'm doing lots of work with. Now I'm going to go through four sections, basically the questions, the methods, the results, and the end. So when we start looking at this at first, is we are interested in really in how you can define and develop a more specific and informed design approach by recontextualized design tools, aspiring for biodiversity and biome-specific regional planning, urban scenarios, architecture, and material development. So this is some examples on how we kind of build our briefs and develop the processes for the research that we're doing. And it deals a lot with how we can harness technical, natural, cultural conditions caused by climate change. Material production must respond and adapt to new conditions faced in the near future. That how can the organization and deployment of architecture contribute with the production of new lifestyles and cultural ecologies. So I think sustainability to a large degree also deals with culture and the way we get used to living maybe with other living organisms. And I think this is a big cultural problem. I mean, you just saw my experience in a way with my house. I think lots of people think this way. And I think actually in our whole history, we've been fighting against the perceived fear of nature, you know, domesticating cats to deal with vermin and so on, right? And this has affected the way we live. So the next part of this, the next question really, is how we should take the account into account the anthropocentric modifications of our environments, and how we can start modeling and understand the environment as an overall model. I think Birger mentioned the Gaia theory and all these things. It's actually things that we find quite interesting to look at as in terms of modeling. This is kind of ongoing experiments when we play around with ecosystem models, with Ecosim, a few other models to try to build larger ecosystems. Don't know what it's going to become yet, because the students are just kind of starting with us right now. So the work is kind of based on a few assumptions. This is a quote from Gideon. I'm not going to stop too much on that. But it's really assuming this, that we as the architects are the synthesizing generalist. And we deal basically with strategizing and coordinating lots of other disciplines. So I think this is something that I like, that maybe I don't know so many things in detail, but I'm interested in getting lots of different people to talk to each other to make projects. And once you actually put something on the table, usually the conversation changes. So multidisciplinary collaborations, I think, is key to any type of work like this. The other thing that we are dealing with is to actually work primarily with adaptive strategies. To think about how we can actually live with our environments. When you think about that, you obviously automatically go to vernacular examples. So we have a few different vernacular. That's actually quite a modern town up here, which is kind of an interesting, it's like a whole project in India, I can't recall the name. And the other products you're probably familiar with, but they're actually types and morphologies that have developed over thousands of years. And I think that intelligence is very difficult to beat, so the question is how you can appropriate this in new contexts. Some people did quite early. I mean, we used lots of references to Buckminster Fuller, Ken Sutange, in this case, Walking Cities, because I think this whole idea of arcologies is a new thing, basically the city as a building or the city as an organism. And we find this quite interesting because it's being exploited in projects like the Masdar City, which I think is it's interesting. I think most architects are very suspicious about this project, but in the same hand, it's doing lots of things which are quite interesting. Looking at vernacular architecture, it looks actually at urban fabric, it looks at how you actually shelter people. It also looks at its energy and systems and services in interesting ways. But for some reason, we are still very suspicious about what this does. And so am I, really. I mean, I just don't think it kind of lives up to all it claims to do. And most of all, I think it's this fear of it as being a gated community as well. Where you can basically prevent the problems from entering the project. So the interesting thing, I think, is maybe this relationship. Michael was mentioning yesterday the difference between discrete and non-discrete architecture. I think this distinction in some instances gets quite difficult, because the question here is where the city begins and ends. You know, is a city building or is it building a city? And maybe some of the problems with these arcologies in the past has been that they were totally centralized. And they dealt with a very much a top-down approach to the overall geometry. So in order to do this, I mean, we're architects, and we're actually pursuing this to develop an ideal space that deals with variation, but it can be addressing questions about environmental change. So as part of this research, I think the discussion is very complicated, so I'm going to leave it here. For those of you who know Patrick, it's quite a lot of words. I'm going to come back to summarizing this in a one simple sentence, actually, at the end of it. We find this quite interesting. It's the idea of autopoiesis, which in a way is a take on cybernetics. It's about how you create self-generating systems. Maybe you can refer to them as bottom-up, but in the way that you can build in some feedback so these systems can grow on their own. We know this. Our economy, our situation is changing. We have all kinds of problems. Some pictures from the UK. And we have all of the kind of some of these doom and gloom reports. I'm not going to dwell on it too much. This is basically related to how we try to inform the models that we're working on. Here is something that we find quite interesting, and it's the idea of predictive change. There is this thing called the GSG, the Global Scenario Group, that deals with future predictions. And it's actually looking at where our world is going to go in the future. It's a group composed of scholars from different disciplines. It's a think tank, if you like, when they try to develop different models, the different scenarios. So with some of those larger projects we do, I think it's quite important to think about what's going to happen here. In a way, they have three different types. It's the conventional worlds, barbarization, and great transitions. Conventional worlds essentially means that things stay the same they are. Things are not changing. We live in a world, most threats have been over-exaggerated and so on. Barbarization is that all the worst predictions come true and we don't do anything about it. And we have this sort of Mad Max scenario. And then the last thing is the great transitions. It's really if we pull together and we try to do something about our situation, maybe we develop carbon economies or biodiversity economies, maybe. Find different ways of actually developing our future way of working. Okay, this is a cybernetic diagram. It's from the state we are in, Insights from Autopoiesis and Complexity Theory by Amanda Gregory. The cybernetics in group dynamics, performance beyond any individual self, and the critical opportunity to articulate and control local customizations while negotiating with a larger context is really the essence of this study. So you find ways of modeling relationships with some type of built-in feedback. And as part of this, I think it's still important that we try to see what this future architecture actually entails. Stephen Hsu just recently said that the green technology, Stephen Hsu is your energy secretary, that the green technology race, it's actually the future space race. You can see this thing down here. China is trying to catch up to the US space program. And it's happening on such a giant scale that you can't really imagine. But the same thing happens with green technology. Okay, so I'm going to go through this primarily just quickly, flip through some slides to say how we're working. We are interested in the idea of, in a way, taking inspiration from national structures, national systems. This is a sample from the Mercedes boxcar. It's kind of how we think about geometry. What's interesting is to see how you organize the complexity of larger building projects that keep getting more complex. And if you really were to do an ecological model that was underlying this whole thing, that we're basically modeling all connections, all associations, and everything, this would get incredibly complex. And We are actually struggling with defining some of those things right now. We ask our students to find their own consultancies, which consultancies I think is a very important part of how you work. And then they find different ways. This is from the drivers of change from Arabs that we use in order to look at different scenarios. Students start with an idea about how you write your abstract. You go into your own thesis proposal and your brief. And then we look at different ways of drawing and modeling the environment. So this starts with the environmental drawing, and then we try to develop ecosystem models from these drawings. This is still kind of early stages, but we are looking at ecosystem simulating programs, eco-modelers to inform. In this case, it's just a grasshopper model that we have a way of actually reading that information. It's very rudimentary and it's under development. We find this quite interesting about how you actually start building a very specific environment from the start. We add to the challenge for our students that they have to go and pick their own sites. This is a student working in Bangladesh, trying to get a turn for the site. Then he has to try to combine the idea of the system models or the ecosystem model together with some of the site information that he gets. And then we're looking at different techniques for creating this into an autopoietic machine. So maybe it's a city, a pattern, a geometry that can kind of grow itself. Again, this is quite an early work. This is just happening right now. And what they're doing right now is that they're looking at different urban precedent studies to try to inform what these projects are doing. And they go first from urban, and then they go into the kind of border between architecture and cities. I mean, I think this is where you find interesting, right? This is the Gadamas old town. It's kind of an arcology because you can't separate one building from the city and vice versa. It's a very fascinating city in Libya. We're also working a lot with technique, but we kind of abandoned lots of the tools that we were using before. We use primarily Python scripting and different ways of interacting with machines. So we go directly to that when we're creating all the prototypes and the output. This is just monolites. We've done a few experiments with new types of production, working with them to improve the machines. Okay, so the outcomes. Urban densification, right? We know that. And this is the first project from London Met. It's a school that very much deals with materiality. So here we are trying to make a house that works in cities. Can work on roofs, you can build, you can densify different sites. And we're going to have to build this in Madrid, Spain next year for the European version of the Solar Decathlon. And it deals in a way with a thick layer of facade or a wall when we have about 900 millimeter for the green systems to actually, or it's like a 900 millimeter green zone in the wall and the roof, which is not the part of the roof which is not covered by photovoltaics. So we're looking at different ways of dealing with water, energy, passive strategies, and these green walls, and we're trying to develop some ideas about what life can take place in this. And this is the system drawing for the project. And at the moment, we are dealing with fabrication of this, prototyping. This is something we started last year at University of Michigan with Wes McGee at the Fab Lab there, working on foam cutting with a KUKA robot arm. And here is at Metropolitan Work, our own workshop, when we are working on the prototype for EcoBuild, which is supposed to be complete quite soon. It's a totally different project, working on a different scale. This is from Chalmers University in Sweden. The question there is deals a lot with an idea about urban patina and social sustainability. So in a way, it's about reclaiming an idea about streetscapes. It's supposed to be an animation. It doesn't work. About reclaiming an idea about the streets, and how you can also keep some of the wetland vegetation like on the waterfront in Gothenburg. This is from the AA, when we basically dealt with large our infrastructural projects dealing with auxiliary conditions from Namib Desert, trying to create water from the fog to build an artificial aquifer so they can regrow the Nara Nara fruit, which has basically died out, which is the local, what the local people were relying on, because the uranium mining had lowered the aquifer in the whole desert, in the Namib Desert. And we are now trying to build new aquifers so they can actually grow their livelihood again. Another project from the Bartlett, dealing more with the decay of organic materials, about how you can actually recycle material. You can have a building that can build itself, and then it can decay, and it wouldn't leave any trace in nature. It's basically looking at some of the old Sami traditions. And another project here from the AA, working with the whole idea of the melting tundra edge. So it's trying to make use of the fact that the tundra is melting, that this whole edge is moving. So marshland is going to be translated to farmland, if you like, or to taiga, forest, if it allows that to grow again. It's going to release an enormous amount of methane, much more than what humankind can ever produce. And it's already happening. It's moving, I don't know how far, but it's a question of hundreds of meters every year, I think, which is quite a long distance. And this project is basically a big mobile shelter that deals with trapping some of the methane to accelerate the photosynthesis. Earl and the students, he worked with one of the botanists from the Eden project in trying to work out the crop rotation in here to see how you can actually change this from marshland to farmland in a 12-year cycle. And then make use of the methane which is released. And afterwards, you really just get the kind of farm or the infrastructure, which is the drainage ditch that are left in the landscape. Okay, it's a very large project, and it breeds, and it also uses the methane to produce other things like algae and so on. And so one of these greenhouses has to be reasonably big, about 2,000 hectares. So it's about 20 big farms, or 20 normal-sized farms, maybe around here, would be able to produce enough food to feed the whole city here of 80,000 people. Okay, another project dealing with ocean deserts, algae farming on ocean deserts when there's actually very little marine activity. So the idea here is to use that for algae farming. So it's just a thin layer, like on the sea, when you can actually build new cities, that would create some type of new aquaculture. So they would become artificial reefs on the ocean deserts. And a very large project, this is the African Greenbelt project. Some of you might have seen this on TEDx. It's Magnus, is a student who won the Holcim Medal for Sustainability in Africa for this. It's basically dealing with the idea of it's a microbe that turns sand into sandstone and is trying to build the whole African green belt by turning some of the sand into stone to find different ways of colonizing and make sure that the green belt is used, because at the moment the green belt projects, they work for a while and then they're chopped down for firewood. So the idea here is that you find some type of incentive for people to use this new ecology. And this is Magnus when he got his Holcim Prize. And all of this work then has been translated into this it's a paper that Steve Hardy and I wrote, Environmental Catalysts, dealing with some of these strategies, but in a more pragmatic sense, for dealing with flooding and the redevelopment of floodplains in London. So it also deals with the idea of retaining some of the floodplains and wetland and still allow the urban densification which is necessary for the city to grow. So that was lots of stuff. Very high speeds, I guess. And I guess what I want to say with this is I think architecture somehow have to be positioned within this future, so the predictive futures. We're actually trying to model and forecast some of these futures right now. This project here very much dealt with that. And we have to think about future legacy. And we also got to design for an idea of time. This is the Chernobyl project here, when the timeline is 240,000 years, where all the contamination is going to be gone. At the moment, they're dealing with growing sunflowers, creating mushroom farms, and finding different ways of getting rid of most of the particles, which are still contaminating the hard surfaces. Not the hard surface. The hard surfaces are safe, but you can't really go off the sidewalks. And I think what we're trying to say here, although we're dealing with a large degree of something which you could consider negatively charged, I think there's also an idea about promoting some type of optimism, that there are things we can do to maybe live together in more sustainable ways. This cow is not so strange as it looks, but one of the biggest greenhouse gas problems we have is the enormous beef industry we have, which is keeps growing, right? And I don't know how much methane gas a cow passes every day, but it's quite a lot. And it's definitely not sustainable in the long run, considering that methane is, I think, 8 times more of a potent greenhouse gas than CO2. Okay, so as an end, I think we architects and design professionals need to actively participate in a change, in the changing of our discipline towards an ecological and non-anthroposophical strategy. I mean, I think this is very, very important for us to be able to manage to live on our planet. This is a critical opportunity for architecture to become increasingly relevant in the world and for our quality of the built environment to consider other things beyond buildings or non-discrete type of architecture. Maybe reclaim ideas about a public domain in our cities, to think more about architecture projects as discrete assemblies. This is still about synthesizing the idea of nature, technology, and people on a range of scales, and reclaiming the public domain in our cities. I think it's quite important. I think when you look at architecture today, I think this is really what's lacking. Discrete and non-discrete, gherkin, potato, blob, all the different types of projects. I think the thing that they really are lacking is the fact that they don't really have there are very, very few public spaces of any real prominence that we create today. We propose to actively participate in this change by promoting discrete ecological architecture in favor of the production of the new sustainable generic. Basically the potatoes, gherkins, and cauliflower, which I really don't care much for, and to conceive an ecological architecture as a holistic, non-anthroposophic, multidisciplinary discipline. I think this is key. Exploit and deploy emerging green technology, both in design and in production, and support innovation at all costs. I think this is quite clear for me as well, that this is really our opportunity. It's really to work proactively with technology and science. To reconceive architecture as an environment for inhabitation as opposed to a machine serving us. I think this is another thing which is important, that we're actually building and creating an environment for inhabitation. Might it be people or other types of living organisms? But at the moment, I think we've been very preoccupied, for a long time, really, about seeing what we do more as a service, a function, it's a machine, it's something that we're going to satisfy. The direct aim is to exploit how passive solar design, future carbon legislation, emerging material science, coupled with emergent design, fabrication and production technologies, could be used to create increasingly innovative and specific design propositions. So I think this is an opportunity for architecture, for ideas, for collaborations to do, to rethink what we do. And I think it's also important to define a new aesthetic and in delight in architecture, something that deals with how architecture is perceived by a larger community. And it's also very important for the architecture to participate in a larger urban stoichiometry when it's actually seen as an integral part of the overall environment. Thank you very much. And I could just say this, I could not draw the diagram. I think that's quite tricky.
Jonas, just a brief question. Have you considered using your rooftop in London as a laboratory?
Yes. We're going to build it on Central House down in central London. Yeah. So we have to build a mice roof down there as well. Basically, what happened on my roof is really this, that the guys, I didn't really do the roof deck or the terrace. So they've been cutting lots of wood on the roof, and then all the sawdust was left under the roof deck. And it's totally just mice everywhere. Mice heaven.
Kind of confused by how it relates to the rest of your talk. I'm just curious of how do you see that statement relating to your projects, your research, things like that.
Basically, what I mean is I don't think nature inherently is good, right? I mean, nature is bound to kill us. We're all going to go the same way. I think we got to find a way of living with nature. You know, so we can't necessarily protect ourselves from it. I think we can find some symbiosis, you know, we can live in greater harmony with nature. But I think nature is bad for us. I have a good friend who's a postdoc in microbiology, and he just keeps giving me this list of all the new organisms that he's looking at every week. And it makes me really frightened to live, really. He's looking at bacteriological corrosion in nuclear storage, and there's so many things that you wouldn't like to know that they're living.
Hi. Well, I guess just to sort of respond to that, I think the mice on your roof and diseases, that's not exactly nature, that's nature out of balance. And I think that the discussion here is pretty much targeted at how do we preserve, you know, stable ecosystems. And so when we infringe upon nature, we're disrupting this natural balance. And so then we suffer, right? And so I think the goal is to, I guess, find out how to put things back into balance, but with us in it, but not the, you know, so it's trying to resolve this conflict that we are somehow separate from nature, I think.
Well, I think that's quite a simple answer. If you look at all the projects that deal with different ways of doing that, actually all of the ones, the projects in Namibia, in Africa, all of these projects, that's the primary concern. I think there comes a point, though, when it's very difficult to know what that is. When maybe ecosystems, maybe lots of different things that condition our environment have changed so much that there's actually no returning point, right? There's this chapter in this book, Out of Control, by Kevin Kelly. It's very interesting, you know, about how they tried to regrow the prairie. And it took them so many years to just try to figure out how to grow an authentic prairie. And they could get close to them, I guess. But not perfect, right? Because of that complexity. I find that interesting because I think most of the things we see are things that we've been part of affecting somehow. And I think they're just different kind of degrees of returns, if you like. So in some cases here, we're projecting new futures. In some cases, we try to go back, like in the Namib Desert. We try to help them reclaim their own ecosystem, right? So that they were surviving from before. So it varies, actually, in some of these approaches. Some of them are more about adapting to change. So if you look at the methane gas harvest, right? It's just really trying to do the best of the situation of climate change and to see what type of new ecosystems would come out of that and how that can actually be monitored and developed as a project. I know the botanist, I don't remember his name, at the Eden Project, but he found this quite fascinating, how you can actually be part of shaping this change somehow. He was talking a lot about crop rotation and it was this because part of this is that they want to reclaim it as farmland so it doesn't go back to taiga or to forest, so for real forest, I guess. But so some of the products deal with the change, some of the products deal with the return to maybe a previous state.
I tend to agree. I mean, as an evolutionary biologist, it's really about adaptive change and finding these dynamic equilibria. And so going back to the past is sort of like a futile exercise or goal. But it's trying to understand the underlying mechanisms. And I guess that's why I'm so attracted to design. And just, you know, I had mentioned earlier about structural complexity, because there's some fundamental pieces of the story that I think, you know, we can use to understand and make predictions about changes and where they're going, but it's not going to be at the same place as it was in the past.
Hi, Jonas. Recently, there is a project for a high-speed train in Norway, and recently there was a calculation that it was environmentally damaging, because on a CO2 balance, it would take at least 70 years before it comes into balance because of the construction costs. So I don't know if this is the just constructing the thing would use so much CO2 or release so much CO2 that it would take 70 years before it would be in balance.
You mean for the Russian?
No, for the Norwegian high-speed train.
Okay.
I'm just wondering, because I'm very fascinated about what you showed us. It was a fantastic presentation, very inspiring. But sometimes I'm wondering, if you did, from a systems head's perspective, the calculation of the construction, let's say what is the balance, the economic and the CO2 balance and so on of the one that collects moisture from in the desert. How would it, did you?
I mean, the moisture in the desert has a very low embodied energy because So the one in the desert, I think, is quite easy in the way that it's a very simple fabric. It's very cheap. It doesn't take much to produce it. And then it's made from laminating this kind of brush wood that they have, which is a local species, similar mechanical properties as bamboo. So that's what the whole structure is made of, basically laminated timber. As in terms of the methane gas harvester in Russia, that's an interesting product in the way that it obviously used some petrochemical products in the production of it. But actually, he did for his technical studies, I actually don't remember it, but he did actually do an embodied energy assessment of that project, looking at the carbon footprint and about how much he could actually get back as in terms of energy, as opposed to how much it was actually costing to produce the structure. And he's also using this plastic, which is poly something. It's one of the better ones, but it still takes some energy to produce.
Great. Thank you.
But they have oil there.